This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
I owe you nothing!
It's just money.
This is madness! Everybody just yells and screams at each other. Nobody's civil anymore!
That's not the kind of humor we do on this show.
Put that coffee down.
I drink your milkshake.
Now you're looking for the secret.
There can be only one.
Everything becomes chaos.
Can you dig it?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. This is episode 6 of season 1. My name is John Kutzmita, joined as always with Brent Johnson. We're starting out the episode with my camera off because I wanted a live reveal reaction to what I'm about to show Brent. So let's check
it out. I can't wait for this.
Let's see what he thinks.
Oh my God! What are you, Frank Sinatra? All of a sudden, you gonna start? Are you a Australian crooner?
The transition is to full blood Aussie is slowly happening. First, you start, you know, as the Yank that we are, like they like to refer to us as, and then in between that and Aussie is the Jason Buck phase. So that's where I'm at right now.
And I saw a picture of Jason yesterday. Uh-huh. I saw a picture of Jason yesterday. I'm pretty sure he had his toenails painted black.
I wouldn't doubt it. He wore a onesie to a conference and a hat. So he's gone rogue. That's happens when you're long volatility.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get cracking here, man. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I was under the weather last week. Shortly after getting our episode up and running, I came down with a case of the milkshake, so I had a rest the last couple of days, but I'm ready to go for today. Probably I'm ready and rested for this weekend's Super Bowl. Go Birds! Philadelphia stomp the Niners.
Go Chiefs! Go Chiefs!
you're just taking Chiefs for the heck of it now.
No, I went to school in Kansas City, you know, so I've been somewhat of a Kansas City fan for a while.
Right on.
Especially when they're good.
Yeah, which seems to be at the moment. So it's going to be a good game. I think Philadelphia has the better team, but Kansas City has more big game experience, and Andy Reid is one heck of a coach. So it's going to be a cool game, and a cool feature of the game is the Kelce brothers. Jason Kelce is the center for the Philadelphia Eagles, and Travis Kelce is the at some point to be Hall of Fame tight end for the Chiefs. And so they're both in the Super Bowl, and there's a pretty cool little thing going on right now. There's a petition to have their mom do the coin toss, so hopefully that works out.
Oh, wow. That is pretty cool. I saw something with her where she's, you know, of course, she was very, objective and, you know, non-committal. And, you know, I don't really care who wins. I just want them both to play well and not get hurt. And you always wonder deep down, do they really like one of the boys better than the other?
Probably the youngest. The youngest always wins out. But they're, you know, they're two true professionals. So it's you really can't hate either one, and it's going to be exciting to see what pans out there. So you got any Super Bowl parties in the mix?
No, we were just talking the other day. Last year we had some people over and watched it, but you know, we're like old now, and it's like a Sunday night. We don't want anybody in our house at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. Stay away. Leave us alone. We'll probably just sit there on the couch and watch it alone.
There you go. Well, it's going to be Monday morning here, so I'm going to have a nice big breakfast somewhere and cheer on the birds. Go birds! So, speaking of fun parties, you've got a fun party coming up tomorrow, is it, with Schiff?
Yeah. So it's Thursday night now. I think this will air on Saturday, but I know tomorrow I've got some deal where I'm doing a debate with Peter Schiff regarding who wins the Cold War, China or the United States. And, you know, for some reason they reached out for me for one side and him the other. So it should be an interesting day.
So do you think that show is going to get, that's a live thing? Will it be posted before or after this?
I'm pretty sure it'll be posted afterwards, but I'm not sure on that. I know we're recording it tomorrow. I'm not sure if it's live or if it's a pre-record. I'm pretty sure it's a pre-record, but I'll let you know once we get it done.
Gotcha. Are you able to reveal what side that you've been picked to defend?
Well, probably not surprising. I'm probably going to take the side that the U.S. will come out on top of a Cold War with China.
Yeah, that would have been my thought too, but I didn't think Peter Schiff was that pessimistic that he's willing to go with communist China for a world takeover.
Well, that's going to be kind of interesting. I'm actually looking forward to it because I kind of want to hear his take here. I know what he'll say as far as, you know, the U.S. being in trouble, but I'm not quite sure what he will say with regard to what China is going to do well. So that's going to be pretty interesting.
Well, for anyone who doesn't get a chance to watch that, I'll summarize Peter Schiff's size of the debate. The Fed, the Fed, the Fed, gold, 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 the Fed, gold. So there you go. There is the debate. You know, speaking of interesting takes and debates on markets, last week, you know, you're a little beside yourself with the Fed rate hike or post FOMC, the press conference, and just the way Jerome Powell was posturing himself and said that, you know, maybe he knows something about NFP. And sure enough, you called him out on that. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, some of those observations and how things unwound last week with NFP and where we got to this week?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the comments I was making last week was it was a little confusing to me, Powell's tone and kind of body language, mainly because he has been so clear spoken for the last year. And I've commented on this several times that he's the most clear spoken central banker. But I felt like his tone and his kind of his mood and just his overall demeanor, while his words were hawkish, that his actions were not like following through on that, or his demeanor was not following through on that. And, you know, subsequent to that meeting, we had a couple days of fairly hawkish data and a super hawkish data on the non-farm payrolls. And the market initially sold off on it. And if you remember from last week, I said, I thought markets would sell off. And I thought that dip would get bought because so many people are behind the eight ball with the markets running so hard for the first 6 weeks of the year. And that's kind of what we had for the first 3 days of this week. Markets ran pretty hard, kind of got back up to the highs, and then they pulled up back pretty hard this afternoon. And so I kind of feel like we're at, you know, I mentioned last week, I thought that we'd get maybe a pop this week, but then by the end of the month, we're going to be heading back down. And, you know, again, wait and see how things develop tomorrow. But so far, that prediction is holding true. I just think that there's been a lot of interesting developments just over the last week. You know, I think, you know, we've discussed several times why would the market rally when the Fed was still hiking. And part of the reason was that sentiment was overly bearish, positioning was overly short, and in many ways it could be nothing more than a short covering rally. And that's really what we've seen over the last 6 weeks. You know, at the end of December, or I think when we did our first episode, I talked about how the put call ratio was very high. A lot more puts were being bought than calls. Positioning was kind of offsides, and it wouldn't surprise me to see a squeeze higher. We've had that, and what's interesting now is that put call ratio has come way back down, kind of back down, you know, to its kind of average level. So it's not even close to being as extreme as it was. Not only that, we've had the short covering rally that we've had is one of the fourth largest short covering rallies in like 25 years. And the market is not really that net short anymore. So it's kind of back to just kind of, you know, even. There's not a big offside position either way. And so I think all that stuff is kind of coalescing at the same time that the Fed's coming out and says, listen, we're still raising rates. Again, body language wasn't hawkish, but the language was. And, you know, I think it was Williams came out today and mentioned that, you know, they may have to go even higher than the terminal rate that they mentioned last year. And so, you know, the hawkish comments from the central banks continue. If we get a CPI print next week that meets or exceeds expectations, you know, we could see a hard pullback from these highs that we've had.
Yeah, you know, talking about put call ratios, the short covering rally, I want to pick some of that apart. But while we're hot on the topic, since you just mentioned it, I feel like this CPI print, they're all so important, but this one just feels like such a biggie. We've come such a long way in the past 12 months, and we've had this like overly bearish sentiment, like you're saying, the put call ratio, you know, everyone was very, very short. But now everyone kind of feels like this is soft landing season. And so now you have this post rate hike rally, incredibly strong NFP. The data is a bit massaged, let's say. It's a little different kind of compilation of the data, if you will. But now we're going into a CPI after all of that history, after all of this, rate cycle process being digested. And now everything is about the terminal rate, right? Like when does the Fed pivot? Because they don't raise until oblivion. And obviously the Fed wants to go on this roadshow jawboning about, well, we'll stay high for longer. That's the impact that we'll make. But yeah, so I'm being long-winded about the point, but man, this CPI print feels as big as any.
Yeah, and again, I can't remember. I want to say it was Williams, but it could have been one of the other central bankers came out subsequent, to last week's meeting and over the last couple of days. You know, he made the comment that we may need to keep, you know, once we get to the terminal rate, it doesn't mean we're immediately turning back down. He said we may have to keep it there for a couple of years. Now, my base case is not that they will keep it there for a couple of years, and you never just wholeheartedly believe everything the central bankers say. But, you know, I've said this several times, don't be certain about anything. I'm not ruling anything out. But I think the point to understand is there was a lot of people who believed that the Fed would just print and print and print. They would never raise rates, and they wouldn't care if inflation just ran away and ate away the debt, you know, inflate away the debt. But I think what we're seeing and what I would encourage people to really think about is the politics of inflation. Don't let that just run wild. You know, the politics of inflation and the pushing back by Main Street against the politicians who you could argue have helped cause all this, right? It's politically unacceptable to run around with 10, 20% inflation year after year. You can get by with it for a year, maybe 2 years, but then, you know, the pitchforks come out. And so that's what the Fed's dealing with right now. And it's not as easy as just, you know, do financial repression, hold rates low, you know, do QE and let inflation run wild. It's a much harder game than that.
Yeah. So you open up a little bit of a Pandora's box there, because not that we'll get into it, but you know, the idea is that the Federal Reserve doesn't actually print money. They print bank reserves. And if anyone is truly responsible for the inflation, this increase in the velocity of money, it was really the transfer payments. It's the stimmies. So the politicians are directly at fault and allowing the Fed, not to say they're not to blame, but allowing the Fed to kind of be the scapegoat. But at the same time, you have the Fed trying to fight inflation. In order to do that, they're raising the Fed funds rate and the yield curve all across the board. Response to that, mainly bond yields have been responding to the inflation. But part of that, I mean, ultimately, that's how the government funds itself. So now you're in this conundrum where, like, the Fed is, I guess, pretending to be somewhat on the white horse to solve the problem that maybe us in the financial markets could somewhat understand isn't completely their fault. But at the same time, you've got a government that can't fund itself because the interest payments are ballooning dramatically. What are your thoughts on some of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that is the case. At the end of the day, you know, a lot of people, there's kind of, I found it very interesting. You know, I've said several times, I think the idea of central bank independence is the biggest myth that I was ever taught. I do not think central banks are independent. Now, they have a modicum of independence, but when the rubber hits the road, the government can basically tell the central bank what to do. They can change laws. They can remove, chairman and all that. They change laws to remove the chairman if they wanted to. So at the end of the day, the central banks really are not independent. And if you needed any more proof that central banks are not independent, just look and you see last fall, they had a conference that talked about why central bank independence is so important. You know, they don't have that conference if it's not a smokescreen. At the end of the day, the Fed does what the government wants them to do. Powell even said the other day, somebody asked him, if the government wanted you or the Treasury asked you to do this, would you push back? And he said, we're the agent for the Fed. We follow what they say to do, or for the Treasury. We act on their behalf. And so, it's going to get really interesting, the power moves between the Fed, the Treasury, and the Congress. And what I mean by that is pre-2020 and COVID, for the most part, the Fed was in charge of monetary policy. But subsequent to that, you've seen the Treasury use its TGA as a way to spend money to push liquidity into the market, which is to a certain extent offset what the Fed has been trying to do. Immediately after COVID, you saw the government come out and mandate loans to certain individuals that applied for them in certain industries. And that, had an effect on monetary policy. And so now you have these three different groups, whereas it used to be the Fed was kind of solely in charge of monetary policy. Now you've got these three different groups saying, wow, I can influence monetary policy too. And it's human nature to, once you realize you have power, to use that power. It's going to be very interesting how this all plays out regarding central bank independence and who's running monetary policy. Is it the Fed? Is it the Congress? Because now Congress is like, wow, we have a lot of, we can actually do this, right? Or is it the Treasury? And does, if the Fed doesn't ever like what the Treasury's doing, will they ever push back? Now, Powell says he won't, but will he not? It's a pretty, and then you throw in the central bank digital currencies, which is now in the mix. It all gets very, 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 in my opinion, one of the most interesting things I've ever seen in markets.
Okay, so with this tug of war happening between policymakers, the decision makers on this trifecta of insanity or madness, we can kind of circle back and look at markets. And as you had mentioned in a previous episode, markets are trading on expectations. So now you have put call ratios way down. Part of the reason is you just let all the, you held the beach ball underwater and let it go. You had this massive short covering, one of the biggest on record. And now all of these things have kind of settled. Now, is this actually a calm before the storm, or is the bear market rally fizzling? What is your take on where we are, kind of the sideways moment?
Yeah, no, I kind of feel like we're going to have another downturn. I think I said at the beginning of the year that my base case was that by the end of Q1 into Q2, we were going to kind of pull back down pretty hard and revisit the lows that we saw last year, probably even go below those. And that's still my base case. I always acknowledge that we could get this short covering rally and kind of an initial, boom. And we've had it. The NASDAQ's up like 15% for the year. I think the Dow's up 6 or 7 and the S&P's up around 10. You annualize that out, that's a 60% return for the NASDAQ. I don't think we're going to be up 60% this year. So I don't think that pace is going to continue. And for all the reasons we discussed, typically, it's not necessarily new sellers come in that push a market lower. What pushes a market lower is when there's just no more buyers, right? And you've a lot of the buyers that we've seen for the last 6 weeks have been forced buyers or people that are covering. And so now that, there's no longer any forced buyers that are getting squeezed, I'm not sure. And, you have some of the New Year's flows that kind of came in at the beginning of the year are no longer there. I think there's I don't want to say the buyers are going to, you know, absolutely disappear, but I don't think you're going to see them at the same level. And, you know, as we've talked about many times, as we get further into this year and the effects of rate hikes that really just started 9 or 10 months ago start to get felt more and more in the economy, I just think that we're due for a very hard pullback.
Well, speaking of buyers missing in action, you had shared a chart on Credit Suisse. Now, is this kind of deja vu with some of the stuff we saw with Deutsche Bank? Does a bank's stock price even matter?
It does, and I'll tell you why it matters. It matters for a couple of reasons. You know, one of the reasons is it affects morale. I mean, if you are working at Credit Suisse and you see the stock price continuing to go down, at some point you have to start thinking about self-preservation. Because if the bank goes under, everybody's looking for a new job. But if everybody's looking for a new job, there's a lot more competition for those jobs that aren't that are not that plentiful. And so, you know, at some point you got to start saying, do I jump off the ship before the ship goes down? That's one thing. The second thing is, and this actually happened to me back in 2008, is, you know, bonuses were typically historically paid in cash. But there, you know, subsequent to 2008, when with global financial crisis, they paid some bonuses in, they called them, you know, I don't remember the technical term, but it was basically these toxic assets that were on their balance sheet that they couldn't get rid of. And so they said, okay, here's your bonus, but it's made up of these, you know, mortgage-backed securities and, you know, distressed debt financing deals. And by the way, you can't sell them for 4 years, but the money's yours. So that's kind of happening again right now. I haven't seen the latest thing but I know a couple of days ago they were, you know, bonuses typically get paid in, you know, late January, sometime in February. They were saying that the bonuses were going to be half of what they were expected to be, and then they were going to pay them in installments. And so, you know, one of the things about Wall Street, whether you like it or not, is there's a lot of very talented people that work there. And if, you know, if they don't feel that they're getting paid what they are worth or should be paid, and there's an opportunity for them to go do their same job at a firm across the street and get cash as opposed to illiquid securities, they're going to do that. And if all your talent leaves, then what do you have left, right? So, and not only that, but then clients see this too. When if you're a, you know, if you're a multimillionaire billionaire and you've got, you know, 20 million bucks or 100 million bucks at Credit Suisse, and you see the stock price keep going down, at some point you got to start thinking about self-preservation as well, right? And then, you know, it's the quintessential run on the bank. Once that happens, you know, it's hard to stem the tide. And that's part of the reason that the stock price has come down so much is clients have pulled a lot of money from Credit Suisse. And so, you know, my guess is that it's going to bounce here. You know, the Swiss will not let it go bankrupt. So I think Credit Suisse will still be around, but whether it's owned by the Swiss government and the Swiss people, or whether it's still a private company, I think that's the big debate.
So it's the perfect visual of how did you go broke slowly, then all at once. So good chart there, a good explanation on that.
It's pretty much.
Yeah, it's interesting to have an appreciation for the morale component to a stock price, especially in a big financial organization in a highly competitive market like the Wall Street investment world is. Well, I figure
let me say one thing before I forget, John. Sorry to interrupt you. But one kind of interesting thing, you know, in the U.S., you know, the Credit Suisse offices are mainly in New York, and then, you know, there's a lot of competitors that they could do. But in Switzerland, you know, in Zurich, the UBS headquarters and the Credit Suisse headquarters are literally right next to each other. And a lot of those guys, they make one move in their career. They either move from Credit Suisse to UBS or UBS to Credit Suisse. And when they move, they just literally just walk across the street. So it's going to be very, very interesting if one of them comes into great trouble, how this all shakes out. I mean, maybe they merge, and maybe it's just you know, there used to be a Union Bank of Switzerland. Maybe that's what they'll make this. Maybe they'll merge the two, and it'll just be the Bank of Switzerland.
Oh, this will be a fun conspiracy theory we can develop. It's all part of of the Great Reset. We're going to make another conglomerate of too big to fail banks now in Switzerland. Yeah. Well, speaking of things kind of slowly crashing or popping or coming to an end, I figure we'll end on a little bit of madness. We had this China spy balloon thing. I mean, I'll just toss it over to you. Any thoughts on this? I still can't quite wrap my head around the whole shenanigans of it.
Well, I find it interesting for a couple of reasons. One, why, if they, you know, remember when it first started popping up, they already had a map of everywhere it had gone. So if they already had the map of where it was gone, it kind of meant that they had been tracking it. And if they had been tracking it, why didn't they shoot it down long before? And so then part of the reason was, well, they didn't want to shoot it down when it was over the continental U.S. Well, come on. I have a hard time believing that that's actually the case, but maybe. Okay, maybe. But then the other thing is that, you know, why not mention it immediately and say, hey, by the way, we know this is here. We're tracking it, rather than some guy with his cell phone, you know, filming it and saying, hey, what's going on here? You know, and kind of getting ahead of the story. And then the third thing is, you know, there's so many satellites up there, and there's so many other ways to, I mean, listen, the U.S. does the same thing. This is not like an isolated incident where the China's spying on the U.S. and it's this big, like, oh, they shouldn't be doing that. Of course they're doing it. And we're doing it too. And we've got satellites, and they've got satellites, and we got spies, and they got spies. So I am kind of wondering, why are they using the balloon? I mean, that's pretty low tech, right? Maybe there's, for some reason that I'm not aware of, but it just kind of seemed like a funny way to you know, and to do it at an altitude where you could literally see it from the ground, right? Like, it's not exactly some stealth operation here. And then finally, when they do shoot it down, can you imagine if they had missed? Can you imagine if they had tried to shoot the balloon down and the missile missed? But then that's the thing, it's a balloon. They shot a missile at the balloon. I mean, did the missile blow up? Or did it just pierce the balloon like a pin and all the air, you know, was the missile armed, or did they just put a little needle on the front of the missile? It's maddening. It's just one of these things. Yeah. It's a crazy story.
I read an article.
Well, and then Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican, I can't remember if she's a senator or a congresswoman. You know, she starts walking around the Capitol building with a white balloon on her shoulder. And I'm just like, this is the level of our leadership right here.
Correct.
That's my thoughts.
It's like a kindergarten playground fight. But I read an article that was talking about, number one, why we had to use a certain missile because the size and it was just so silly. I felt like you could have stuck a kid on a prop plane with a what are those things? A slingshot and could have shot it out of the sky. But then they're talking about, well, we had to use this particular missile, and the cost of the missile versus the cost of the balloon. Yeah. All China has to do is just deploy a shitload of these balloons and suddenly we're out of missiles. It was just getting so ridiculous. But
I need to find that article. I did see my favorite tweet of the week. My favorite tweet of the week when it was fantastic. Somebody like said, isn't this something we probably could have just let Tom Cruise take care of this one?
Nice.
So, you know, we, because it wasn't like a big threat, right? It's just this balloon just kind of floating along. So anyway, I thought that was pretty good.
It did kind of somewhat turn into Mission Impossible. Well, look, man, we're right at our mark. It was a good episode. We covered a lot, you know, and to put a exclamation on the end of it.
Eagles.
So
I'll send you some Kansas City barbecue when. I'll send you some Kansas City barbecue when the Chiefs win.
Oh, low burn. Well, we'll see. I'll be banging the pots and pans when the Birds bring home Super Bowl number two. So, all right, man. Good chat with you. We'll see you next week.
All right.